So thank you very much for this opportunity to come and address you guys today. Masala had been chatting to me a little bit and said a lot of the guys in the church and a lot of the youth and friends of theirs have got questions about Christianity. And particularly gave me like this list of questions about God and why does God do these things and what about suffering and is God moral and, you know, what about gays and lesbians and is the church a bunch of bigots and we try to come together with an idea of how can I talk about some of these issues and create a platform through which we can ask some questions and get some discussion going. It's coffee conversations. So I'm going to give a little talk entitled, Is God Good? And it's a huge topic. It's quite wide. I'm going to pull out two in particular that I want to talk about. And then I want you to reflect a little bit on what I'm saying. I don't want you to jump too quickly through the points that I make. And then I want you to ask yourself some questions and send them to the WhatsApp line and let's get some debate and discussion going. If you're a Christian here today, I want to encourage you and I want to edify you and I want to build you up to say that the Christian faith is true. Not just true because I say it is, true like the bench that you're sitting on. And if you're not a Christian today, I want to challenge you to look at this thing called Christianity, the claims that it makes, and what I believe is the true truth behind that. All right, you ready? Okay, next slide. We're trying to get a signal for how to change slides. Initially, I thought I was going to do a little dance, but I was going to say next slide. So I studied medicine at the University of Pretoria. Next slide. And I'm an anaesthetist. I was up till recently the head of Grey's Hospital, HCU. I'm affiliated with the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Next slide. That is what an anaesthetist does. He puts you to sleep. It's the last thing you see, you know, just before you drift off to sleep. I'm so good that sometimes when I talk, people start falling asleep. So if you notice your friend nodding off, just give him a nudge. This is what we actually do. Once you're asleep, we kick back, relax, and play some Sudoku. Next slide. This is my family. My wife in the back there and my two sons, Josh and Nathan. Miranda's looking after them at the moment. Next slide. They're quite a handful, as you can see, but incredibly cute. You'll see Josh there in the top right. I couldn't find a single photo of him where he's not pulling a face. Next slide. I don't know where he gets it from. Next slide. So, you've heard a little bit of my research background. Next slide. I take my research quite seriously because that's who I am. That's who God made me to be. I'm not a researcher, and that's not the core of who I am, but it's a big component of who I am. And it's played a big role in my process of coming to faith and understanding the truth behind Jesus. I take my research and the claims about the world we make very seriously. And I believe that the same rigor, the same intellectual process that you can apply to this research, you must be able to apply to your faith as well. Because if it's not true, it's not worth following. So that plays a big role in what I try to do in the way that I think about myself and the work that we do. Next slide. When I went to Canada, I started working with a research group and my PhD leader, who's a brilliant, smart, intelligent guy, one of the world leaders in perioperative research, said to me, Rata, you're a really great guy. We really enjoy having you here. But this whole thing about believing in this figure in the sky, this God thing, it's a delusion. Like, seriously, why would you believe this thing? It's crazy. It just doesn't make sense. It's irrational. It's anti-intellectual. How can you believe in this, you know, grandfather in the sky thing? Next slide. And that caused a crisis of faith for me, where I had to ask myself, is this stuff really true? And there was a lot of stuff going on in my life at that stage. Questions about morality and, you know, can you actually believe that there is a God? And all the questions that you struggle with sort of came to the fore there. I spent 6 months, 8 months studying it as robustly and as objectively as I could. And at the end of that time, I came to the conclusion that Christianity is true. The claims it makes about the existence of God and the resurrection of Jesus Christ are true, true, true. Objectively true. It's not just because the minister said so, or your dad said so, or the Bible said so. I can make an argument from the world that we live in. Next slide. Belief in God is reasonable and rational. See the joke there? Next slide. There is a God. And the God, the characteristics of the God that exist fit those of the Christian God and the Islamic God and the Jewish God. But the truth of Jesus Christ and the resurrection prove that the Bible is true. And these two facts, the existence of God and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, are the things that make me a Christian today. Next slide. So, that's my background. Let's dive into this thing. You ready? Right. Next slide. I'm going to be talking about suffering as a starting point. And the question that I want to ask you is, why is there suffering? And the question that you ask yourself is, why is there suffering? And how do we deal with suffering? And what has Christianity and the world got to say about suffering? Next slide. Now, before I do this, I just want to say this question, or make the statement, everybody needs to answer this question, not just the Christians and the Jews and the Muslims. Every person needs to deal with this question of suffering. Every faith structure needs to deal with this question of suffering, because everybody suffers. I mean, next slide. If you look at the things that we experienced, tsunamis, war, famine, disease, you cannot be human and not deal with this in your worldview, in the way that you understand the world to be. And the question that gets thrown at Christianity is, how is it possible to have all of this stuff and there is a God? It's wrong. You agree? You've had that question yourself? Okay. So the first point is, next slide. If there is no God, then what are we so upset about? What do I mean by that? Next slide. If there is no God, then there is no problem. Next slide. This guy is Richard Dawkins. He's an arch atheist. He's like the poster boy for atheism. This is his worldview, the way that he understands the world. There is no God, right? In his worldview, in his understanding of the world, there is no God. He says, a universe of blind physical forces, genetic replication. Some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason for it or any justice. In a world where there is no morality, no God that commands morality, stuff's going to happen. If we weren't in a church, you'd put that in a different way. It's going to happen. And it's just going to happen because that's the way it is. And so what? On Richard Dawkins' worldview, this unhappiness that you have about all the people dying in a tsunami and the cancer that the little children got is meaningless. Next slide. He says the universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is. In a world of chemicals and biological stuff, without any mind, without any morality, some people get hit by a bus and some people don't. Some people get cancer and some people don't. Tsunamis come and kill some people and some don't. You just happen. But I want you to think about what happens when there is a tsunami or when a child gets cancer. We don't just go, whatever. It affects us. And we go, this is wrong. There's something wrong with this process. We can't live like Richard Dawkins wants to live. We just can't live like this. We are programmed. We are built in such a way that when we see these things, we respond in a certain way. That is human nature. And I think it's quite a powerful argument for the fact that we are more than what Richard says we are. And although he says these things about the way the world really is supposed to be, you must hear him speak and how angry he gets about injustice and about people being hurt. He's saying one thing with his mind, with his mouth, but he lives a different experience. Our lived experience of being a human fits in with the fact that we have this morality, this understanding of what is real, what is right, what is wrong. Next slide. Just think about that for a moment. Is that it's not just Christianity that has to deal with this argument. If you say that there is no God, then you as an atheist must give an answer, an explanation for why is the world the way it is. Why do we respond to this like with suffering? If you're a Buddhist, you need to give an argument for suffering in this world. The argument for Buddhism, suffering is that it's actually an illusion. The death of your daughter or the death of your son or the death of your loved one is just an illusion, and you need to let go of that. Does that fit into the way that you really experience the world? Okay, so everybody needs to answer this question. Next slide. If there is no God, then there are no objective moral values or truths. Morality cannot be held or grounded in anything. What do I mean by that? Next slide. This is Darwin. He wrote, if men were reared under precisely the same conditions as hive bees, there can be hardly a doubt that our unmarried females would, like the worker bees, think it a sacred duty to kill their brothers, and mothers would strive to kill their fertile daughters, and no one would think of interfering. If we are evolved creatures, then the things that we do, that we think are right or wrong, are only being done because we've evolved like that. They have no real moral content. If we evolved down instead of the way that we have through bees, then we would be doing this and we'd consider that moral. Next slide. Michael Ruse is a really well-read, well-spoken atheist. When people come and engage in debates with me, I tell them, don't read Dawkins, read Michael Ruse. If you want to really engage with what atheism says, don't read the popular stuff. This guy writes well, writes carefully. Listen to what he says about atheism. Next slide. He says, why should I be good? The answer is that there are no grounds whatsoever for being good. There is no celestial headmaster who's going to give you 6 or 6 billion 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 of the best if you are bad. Morality is flim-flam. He calls it like a magician trick. Morality has no basis if evolution is true. Next slide. Morality is a biological adaptation. Considered as a rational, justifiable set of claims about objective something, ethics is an illusion. Morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction, and any deeper meaning is an illusion. When I say that it is in all times, all places wrong to torture a child for fun, I believe I'm making a statement that is objectively true. It has content, it has meaning, it actually means something. It is wrong to do that. And that can only be so if there is a God, according to the atheist himself. Because he says that when I say those words, they have no meaning at all. They have no true moral weight behind them. They're just a social construct that we've created. He doesn't say that we must go and do it, because he'll say that these adaptations that we have compel us to act in this way, but it's actually just an illusion. So if you take away God, there is no morality. There's no objective morality at all. And the statement that it is wrong to torture children for fun is an illusion. It's flim-flam. I want to ask you if that is the way that you experience the world. If that fits with your lived morality. Does it fit with the way that you experience injustice, pain? Does it fit better with Michael Ruse's understanding or more with the Christian understanding? Next slide. Number 3. Now, before I dive into this, because suffering is a really complex thing, I just want to say every time somebody asks a question, there is a person behind it that is asking the question. What I mean by that is that when I ask a question maybe about morality, perhaps I'm doing psychology in my class, or I'm doing philosophy, and I've got this deep intellectual struggle in trying to understand what the basis of morality is. But maybe you ask a question about suffering, and you're asking the question because your mom just died of cancer. Now, the answer that I give to me and the answer that I give to you are going to be two very different questions. And so when you ask these questions, it's important to understand why the person is asking the question. And so what I'm trying to do here is unpack this a little bit as we go through these different levels. I'm talking about almost like philosophical concepts, and I'm going to be channeling this down to your own experience of suffering and your own experience of pain, and how I believe Christianity answers it at the top level, but also in your own lived level. Next slide. So this is a question that we get a lot. Evil exists. You agree? There's evil in the world. How is it possible that evil can exist if God is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good? I mean, that keeps you up at night. If God is loving, if God is all-powerful, if He can do everything, why let there be a world in which there is suffering? You agree? It's one of the biggest challenges against Christianity. You say God can do anything, and so why doesn't He cure cancer? How many amputees have you seen that have grown their limbs back? What's this all about? Okay, next slide. So I'm going to give you an argument or a framework which I believe speaks quite powerfully to this. Anybody ever been in love? Yes? No? All right. I want to tell you a little story. Next slide. This is John. John meets Sally. And then they fall in love. To fall in love, you must be able to freely choose to love somebody. So if I pull out a gun and I hold it up to your head and I say, "Do you love me?" What's she going to do? She's going to fall on her knees before me and she's going to say, "I love you, Raitza." So you go home and you say to your family, "A strange thing happened. Raitza came to speak at the church. Pumzili fell onto her knees and she said she loved him." Is it important that I hold a gun at her? It's critical, because forced love is not real love. You must be able to choose freely for love to mean anything. So John chooses to love Sally, and Sally loves John. But then what happens? Next slide. And again. John decides, no, Fiona down the road looks much better. Next slide. And so he leaves. Now John has exercised his free will to choose who he wants to love. And Sally is suffering as a result of that. And Sally cries out, "My heart is broken, I have pain, I have suffering, my heart is sore. How can God do these type of things?" In a world that is created where true love can exist, there must be the potential to be hurt. Because that person, that entity that chooses to freely love can choose not to love. Which is crazy. That God would create us in such a way that we could freely choose not to love Him. Or freely choose to love Him. And so to have free will means that there must be the possibility of pain and harm in it. Now you look at this, and depending on which sex you are, you're either unhappy or happy with this example. Next slide. But a lot of you are students. So you decide to go out and have a huge party. Next slide. And you crash a few beers. And the next slide, you jump in a car and you're wrapped around. And I've seen this working at Grace Hospital, sitting in the ICU on a Friday, Saturday night. People choose to drink and to drive, to pick up a knife and to pick up a gun, and to act out their choice of free will. And as a result, we have suffering. Next slide. And my family is an example of the suffering, in that my children are both adopted. Somebody has chosen to give them away. And they, as they grow up, will have to deal with this fact of dealing with suffering. But we have chosen to adopt them and to recreate a family. So this is one of these key things. God allows, I believe, or has created a world in which there is true opportunity to love. But that is only possible by generating free will. And that has the consequences of this. Next slide. Think about that for a little bit. The choices that you make have consequences on the people around you. Are you a John or you're the Sally? Next slide. Another argument against Christianity is that there's just so much evil in the world that God can't exist. All right? There's just so much evil. There's just so much suffering and pain in this world that it's impossible that a good God can exist. Now, the first thing I want to say is that the majority of us don't commit suicide. Would you agree with that? Which suggests to me that on average, the world is good enough for us to continue living despite all the evil in it. So that's just the first comment. The second thing is, next slide. When we ask these questions about suffering, we often ask why. Why? We will say the statement, there can be no good reason why I should go through the suffering. There can be no good reason why so-and-so has got cancer, why my daughter has got cancer. There can be no good reason for these things. But can we really say that we understand all of the reasons? If there is a being that created all of us, that created this universe and that sustains it, if there is an entity such as God, would we not be a little bit stupid to imagine that we could understand all of the reasons, all of the background to that, to understand all of the implications of everything that we have to face? It's a little bit like when I take my dog to the vet. I've got a Great Dane, two of them actually. And when the Great Dane sees the vet, he wants to get all 60 kilograms onto my shoulders because he's scared of it. It's like, what are you doing to me? Why are you taking to this place? They stick things up my bum and they shove things down my front and they chop bits off me. Like, what's this all about? The dog cannot understand the process that he's going through because my ways are higher than his ways in some ways. So what happens if there is an entity that oversees us, that loves us, that is taking us through a process where it's not all about just living a good, happy life, but there's something more beyond that? It's not reasonable to say that if there is a God, like I believe there is, of this power, of this magnitude, of this wisdom, that the things that he is doing are in some ways like us taking my dog to the vet. Next slide. When I worked in Albert the Thule Hospital, I worked in the burns unit as an anesthetist and spent about 2-3 years there. And the child of the age of whatever, 2-3 years old, burned their hand, their limb, 30-40% burn wounds. And every week, we take the child kicking and screaming literally into the theater. And according to the child, these guys come in, they grab him, they shove a thing on his mask, they take a knife, they cut away at his flesh, it makes him bleed, he's sore, he's in pain. We do it every week. In his mind, he's in hell, and he is going through suffering. But to what end? We are doing that to cut away the dead flesh, to prepare the child so that he can move on. And what if part of our living here is going through that process? That the world that we live in here is not all that there is. And having a nice home and a nice house and a nice TV is not all that there is. And that this is potentially training for something else, a preparation for something else. And that's what Christianity believes. That God is preparing us for something beyond this life. Next slide. And in the Christian worldview, this world is not all that there is. So we had some pizzas here today. If I had to 4 people and I cut my pizza into 4 bits, we're all going to get a decent slice. If I took that pizza and then sectioned it into so that everybody got a slice, how many slices would we have? Like, how much would you get? Almost nothing. And so we believe that after this life, there is an eternity of living, of an existence beyond this world. And so the little bit of suffering that we have here is like an infinitesimal part of this pizza compared to an eternity of living with God. And so the suffering pales into insignificance. And we all suffer to get something of value. You want to run the comrades? You got to train. You want to pass your exams? You got to study. Nothing worthwhile comes without hard work, without some suffering. That's the lesson of life. Next slide. The fifth point. Why does God allow suffering to me? So it's all very nice and academic, you know, at the arm's length, until you start to suffer. Next slide. Again, every one of you must and will have to deal with this question. And I speak particularly to those that are under 35, 20, because you feel pretty indestructible. About a month ago, I started looking, cutting my kids' fingernails, and I can't focus so properly because my eyes all of a sudden are not working so well. I'm 42. It's like, what the heck's happening here? And I've got like a bad knee, and I'm getting a little bit slower, and I'm like, what's happening? Next slide. Every single one of you will die. You will die. Like, what a travesty. It's so wrong. There's something wrong with the fact that we will die. We know that it's not right that we die. You're going to get a cancer. You're going to get a heart attack. You're going to get hit by a bus. Something will happen to you. You can pretend like it's not going to happen to you, but you have to face the fact that your life is going to come to an end. And that coming to an end is suffering. You lose the ability to run fast, to hear well, to think as fast. You get old. It will happen to you. And every day you've got to deal with this issue of this life that I'm living is coming to an end. What does that mean? Where's the meaning in it? What is the purpose in it? Where do you find your identity in? You're going to have to deal with this. Next slide. For me, my period of suffering, I got quite bad depression when I was overseas in Canada to the point where I wanted to commit suicide. And the whole process of going through that depression, realizing that I'd built my life around my career, that I existed just to make myself look important, that broke a huge part of this arrogance and superciliousness off me. And it's like taking a hammer to a piece of marble and chopping off chunks. It changed my personality in that it made me less of an ass, less arrogant, more humble, more able to understand and to engage with other people. It brought me to the point where I realized that I needed a savior, that I needed Jesus. Without the suffering, I wouldn't be the person that I am today, and I think it is a better version of who I am. So in my life, the suffering has been a process of changing me, and I can bet you it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't gone through the suffering. Because it's only when you go through suffering that you're motivated or pushed to change in some way. And I believe from a Christian viewpoint that God designed our life so that every step of the way, as you get older and older and older, you have to deal with this fact that your life is coming to an end, that it's not all about you, that there is something else. Where are you going to find that meaning? Next slide. So, in summary, if there is no God, there is no problem. But that's not how we experience life. Next slide. If there is no God, there is no objective morality. And so all of these statements saying this is wrong don't have any basis in it. Next slide. True love needs true free will, the ability to choose. And that has the potential to cause or create harm. Next slide. Life is more about more than just happiness. There is something beyond this. Next slide. And this suffering is something that we all need to deal with. All right. Next slide. Take a moment. That's a lot of stuff to deal with. I hope we're recording it so you can go back through it and then, you know, criticize it and see all the holes in the argument. So that's one of the big things is about suffering. How is it possible that God can have suffering, can allow suffering? How do we deal with suffering? What does Christianity say to suffering? Every religion needs to answer this. It's not just the Christian's burden. It's maybe heavier for the Christian because we say that God is true and that God is good. But I believe that these answers, because there's so many to them, they actually provide a really good response, better than any of the other religions. And these fit the best with the way that you actually experience life. Right. Next slide. I'm going to deal with two more issues. The bad God thing. How is it that God is allowed to or does judge people in the Old Testament? Why does he do all of these things where he smites these guys and kills these people and commits genocide over here? According to Richard Dawkins, the God of the Bible is one of the most unpleasant characters. He's got this whole little thing that he says. Misogynistic, angry, vengeful. How do we deal with it? And it's probably one of the biggest topics, one of the biggest criticisms of Christianity that I ever come across. Have you heard it before? Yeah? Have you thought about it yourself? And you can say yes, because the pastor isn't looking. All right. Good. So let's first talk about judgment. Next slide. So before I dive into this, I want to say, or introduce something. One of the big problems in any society, if you're a boss in your work, if you're a parent in your home, is how do you deal with justice and mercy? So justice is, if somebody does something wrong, they need to be punished for it. Yes? But But at the same time, how do you deal with the mercy where you say to the person, well, you should be punished, but I forgive you? There's a tension in law, in running your department at work, in running your home, between those two things all of the time. How do you punish somebody, but at the same time, how do you balance that issue of mercy? Next slide. So what is justice? Next slide. This is a definition. Justice involves defending what is right, okay, and thereby refusing to tolerate what is wrong. I demand justice for the attack on me. So I defend what is right. You may not attack me, and I won't tolerate the attack. I need to act against it. I need to do something against it. Okay? Next slide. When I was working at Albert Luthuli Hospital, a child came in of the age of about 4 months. And the parents had had a fight. The child was in the cot, and the dad was drunk, and he was having a fight with the mother. And during the fight, he took a match, and he lit the child alight. He had a synthetic blanket on, and this blanket burnt into the child's legs, and it burnt the child all the way up to the mid-thigh. So, I mean, I remember this like yesterday. We take this child into the theater with the burns team, and basically the child had been burnt down to the bone above the knees. And we had to amputate a six-month-old child across the knees, just like that. Now, I ask you, and I know what my answer was to that, should this guy be punished? Yes? I mean, severely punished. There's a demand. He has, out of his own choice, chosen to irreparably harm this child physically and inflicted a huge amount of pain and suffering on that child. There is a huge demand for justice. And I would put it to you that any God or any judge who did not punish that man would not be worthy of being called a judge, would not be worthy of being called God. You cannot let some things go. You just can't let it go. There must be a judgment for that. Next slide. What if you were that guy? What if you were the person who did that? How would you be feeling now? Feel that anger? Feel that resentment directed at you? What do you want now? What do you want? You want compassion. You want mercy. You want somebody to say to me, I was drunk, I've been having severe depression at work, I haven't had anything, I made a huge mistake, I'm lying here on the ground, I'm begging you, please forgive me. How do you deal with that question? This is a question not just for the courts and law, it's a question for religion. Next slide. How do you untangle this knot of justice and mercy? Next slide. Christianity, uniquely among all religions, does this, sorts this problem out. God says, evil must be punished. You burnt the child. You will pay the price. You are guilty. There's no doubt about it. He's a God of justice. And in the next breath, he says, I climb off my position as judge, and I take your place for the punishment. That is the core of Christianity. God will not allow sin to go unpunished. He knows that you are guilty. But the brilliance of Christianity is that he says, he, the God himself, the judge, will take your price. So there is a price paid. The justice part is satisfied. But he is the one who takes the punishment, allowing you to receive the mercy and the compassion. That is the brilliance of Christianity. That is the brilliance of God and the sacrifice that Jesus gave. Next slide. That's profound. Next slide. So is God bad? You know, is he like really bad? I couldn't find a picture of God being bad, but... And just by the way, God is not a white male sitting in the sky, despite what Michelangelo said. Next slide. So the one that always gets pulled up in any conversation and definitely comes up is the genocide of the Canaanites. So it says in the Bible that the Israelites were commanded to destroy the Canaanites. They went in, they massacred everybody, they killed a whole lot of them, wiped them from the face of the earth. There was a genocide against the people. All right. That's the charge that's laid at the feet of God. Remembering that God is the source of morality, the source of right and wrong, but all those things. But anyway, God is bad. Next slide. So let me first start off saying and referring to what I've just told you, that God is both the God of justice and of mercy. If he is God, he cannot tolerate sin. He cannot tolerate evil. He cannot allow it to go unpunished. He must be punished. No matter where, no matter who, no matter what. Evil must be punished. All right? I've already shown you that he provides a solution to that. Next slide. Now, before I start off this, I want to say that God's justice is impartial. Because there's a big thing There's a big thing made about the fact that the Israelites destroy the Canaanites. But if you read the rest of the Bible, you see that God also judges and punishes the Israelites. He's not playing favorites. He says, I will judge you for the way you have lived, and I will punish you for all the detestable things that you have done. And he's talking to his own people. God is not us. God is not human. God sits as God himself over judgment, over people. He will not tolerate sin, evil. And he judges it in his own people, and he judges it in the other nations. And in fact, the majority of the Old Testament is not about the other nations getting hammered. It's about the Israelites themselves dealing with God and fighting, and God punishing them for them turning away from him and committing evil. So he's impartial. Next slide. God is patient. God speaks about the Canaanites, and he says, after four generations, your descendants will return here to this land, to Canaan, for the sin of the Amorites do not yet warrant their destruction. The Amorites are the Canaanites, and he's speaking to the Israelites, four generations, 50 to 80 years' time, 300 to 400 years, that God waited and waited and waited and waited and waited, with everybody going, why are you waiting, God? Why aren't you punishing the sin? Because everybody's complaining about the fact that God did punish the sin, but for the other 400 years, they're complaining that God still hasn't punished the sin. Right? So he's patient. He's impartial. Next slide. God is specific. He didn't just punish everybody. He punished the specific group of people for specific sins within a specific boundary. So it's not just this blanket destroy everybody. He says, for these sins I'm going to punish you, and it's these people particularly. Next slide. And the sin that they committed and the evil that they committed justifies the punishment they received. So what do we know about the Canaanites? Canaanites used to worship this bull god. And what they used to do is they used to heat this thing. It's made out of copper. It stands like this. Used to heat it up until it's red hot. And then they would take infants, children, and sacrifice it to their god. And they would throw the children onto the copper, boiling copper, and it would run down the arms of the child into the mouth of this idol and burn to death. That type of culture, that type of destruction and killing and maiming of the youth, of the elderly, used to kill people and put them in the walls when they dedicate their buildings. This type of immorality, this type of cultural distortion is the norm in this thing. Now, if you were living in that time, would you not be crying out to God for justice? And so God brings justice on the people after waiting patiently, not tolerating it specifically. And then he also does it compassionately. What do we mean by compassionately? Next slide. Here's an article. It's about a year old now. It says, living descendants of biblical Canaanites identified via DNA. There's still Canaanite DNA to be found. They weren't all wiped out. Because God didn't wipe them all out. He gave them an instruction to do it, but the Israelites didn't do it. And so God showed compassion on some of those people as well. And there are records in the Bible of the Canaanites engaging with the Israelites afterwards. So God is not a tyrannical, imperious, random person that just attacks anybody. He's compassionate. He's justified. He's impartial. He's focused on a specific task. And what I find fascinating is that people, when God doesn't judge, complain that God isn't judging these people. How can there be suffering in the world caused by other people? But then the complaint that is thrown against Christianity is that when God does judge people, then they're unhappy with how he acts there as well. Next slide. It is in his nature to be compassionate. The Lord isn't really being slow about his promises, as some people think. No, he's being patient for your sake. He does not want anyone to be destroyed, but wants everybody to repent. That is his nature. And the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament are the same God. This is characteristic of God, is that he waits and he waits and he wants other nations, his nations, all people to come to him and not just deal with that punishment. Next slide. In fact, the pinnacle verse, the center of Christianity, is this verse. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, so that everyone who believes in him will not perish but will have eternal life. And like I spoke to you guys about this justice mercy thing, this is the justice mercy. God will not tolerate sin in your own life, in your family's life, in a country's life, in a nation's life. He will not tolerate sin. But he is patient. He does not want us to face destruction, to face this punishment. And so he sent his Son. And the first half of my experience of coming to know Jesus Christ was dealing with all of these intellectual issues and these intellectual questions. And I came to a point where I became an intellectual follower of Jesus. But the second half of my journey was understanding this, that I wasn't as perfect as I pretended to be, that my decisions that I made in my life, I put myself first, I hurt other people, I lived an immoral life, I just hid it very well from everybody else. And I had a serious, serious problem. Because if this God that exists is really there, and he is, then I've got a problem, just like I believe all of us do. And secretly in your heart, you're not as good, you know that you're not as good as you pretend you are. And God will not tolerate sin. He will not tolerate evil. So what do I do when I find it in my own heart? And this is the key for me, that Jesus Christ says that he will take that sin, he will take that punishment on himself, and in return, free you from that punishment. But all that it takes is that you come to Jesus Christ and that you follow him. And that's why I'm a Christian today. Why I believe it is objectively true. It is emotionally and morally true. It fits with your lived world experience. And spiritually, I believe it is true as well. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you guys.